Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Jennifer Corning, and we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. The Archie Bray Foundation in Helena is an apt reflection of Montana, built by hard work and inspiration, political, and ultimately distinguished by amazing creations of the land. First conceived in the 1930s, Archie Bray Sr. expanded the family brickyard and established a foundry for ceramic arts in 1951. Joined by a cadre of artists and supporters, the Bray was a dusty shed that turned out famous ceramic artists like Peter Volkos and Rudy Audio. The kilns are still active and firing what Bray Sr. called crooked and crazy-shaped pots. Corby and I are at the Bray to learn more from director Rebecca Harvey.
Welcome, Rebecca. It's a pleasure to visit the Archie Bray Foundation, or as it's known, Bray, the 26-acre historical brickyard and campus. Before we get into talking about the center itself, you are relatively new to the center. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. I have a long-time career at Ohio State. I was a professor there for a long time and department chair and did a lot of upper administrative work. I then went to the Royal College of Art in London in the UK and was head of program there for ceramics, glass, metals, and jewelry. During COVID, I had a studio practice on a small island in the San Juans, and it was there that I really thought, wow, Rebecca needs people to talk to. I was so used to, you know, teaching and making have been part of my practice forever. So when the job at the Archie Bray came up, it fulfilled studio work, which I love to do. I have a beautiful studio here, which I'll show you guys later. And I can also pull the big levers and move the field forward. So my favorite story is, like, if I was an astronaut and someone said, do you want to run NASA? I'd be like, yeah, I could do that. So the Bray is like my NASA, top-notch people and really amazing things going on here.
I've known about the Bray for a long time. It has really an international reputation. But I think it's sort of unusual. I don't know that people in Montana know it as much as they should. I have a background in art, so it's always been important to me, and I've known many of the artists that have been here. But let's go back to the beginning and tell us, who was Archie Bray Sr., and what was his interest in the ceramic art world?
The brickyard was started back in the 1880s by a man whose last name was Thurston, so it was a historic brickyard. The clay came down from Mullen Pass on the railways, and it was made here in very kind of primitive conditions. Archie Bray came in the 30s and built the English-style beehive kilns, which was a really big deal. But Archie Bray was really a lover of the arts, and he wanted to expand kind of what was happening here. So his idea was to make it, you know, to bring culture to Helena. You know, and I think the railroad certainly helped with that, because people could come out. And there are stories of Archie meeting folks from New York downtown at the railroad depot, and he'd just be covered in clay dust and bring them out here. And so he was an amazing guy.
When you say a brickyard, you mean a brickyard. This is where they were making tiles and bricks. When did the whole art element enter into the foundation?
I think it was the early 1950s, Archie Bray passed away suddenly. His son Charlie took over the company. Charlie was an airplane pilot, really not that interested in ceramics. Archie Jr. had the factory, and they were still making some bricks. They were also making ashtrays and flower pots and things like that. And that's kind of when Pete and Rudy came here. Francis Senska was their teacher and said, oh, you know, I know this guy out in Helena who's making bricks. So they would make bricks and stuff in the day and functional ware in the day. And then at night they'd make these other things. And there's some really interesting letters and where Archie's complaining about, like, I don't know what this crazy stuff is they're making, like, at night. It's just like, they should just be making flower pots. They should just be making bricks instead of these kind of weird sculptures.
the art element. I love that. So the Bray has been around for 75 years, and it has expanded incredibly. And we're going to talk about a lot of those things, residencies, the clay that is available here, classes, sales, shows, and even a podcast. But let's start with residencies. That's a really interesting aspect of what the Bray is about. Tell us about the residency program.
And that has been, you know, since its inception, there's been always a residency program. I think it's really important for artists to work with other artists. That's really, really important. A lot of times people work in their own studios, and it's great for people to come together. And Montana is a lovely place, particularly in the summer, and it's easy to live here in the summer. So the summer residencies were kind of the beginning. They started off in the full building. So we have 10 long-term residents that are in that building. They're here for 1 to 2 years, and they come from all across the country and all over the world. And it's really true what you said about like not being as well known in Montana as we are outside of Montana. I've been in Berlin and people know what the Bray is. I've been here to the Rotary and people are like, I think I went there to have my high school picture taken. So we're less well known in our own, kind of our own backyard. So the residency program is really important, and we really focus on cohort and community building. So, you know, we have 5 residents per year, so 10 long-term. And it's not just the work that they make, it's the work that they make next to other people making really high-level work. So, and the work is all incredibly different. It's not like one person comes in and someone else starts making work that looks like theirs. They're all really amazing. And then the public comes through. We're really open to that. And it's a really important part of what we do. We also have a summer residency program that's much more... It's 3 months. It's in the summer. We bring 10 people in. They're in a much more rustic studio. It's in actually the base of one of those old Scotch kilns, so it's really interesting to have artists working inside of what used to be a kiln.
People that become a long-term resident, a year or 2 years, they have to really pack up and come here and settle in. It's sort of a bonus, but a certain personality type would only fit the bill to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed who applies based on that residency, mm-hmm. the long-term residency? Yeah.
The long-term residency, there's a always a large cohort of artists who are starting out early in their career, usually kind of straight out of grad school or straight out of some other experience like that, where they're still kind of transient in their lifestyle, and they can pick up and move here and do that for a couple years. We've talked about the idea of like, what if we just had a 1-year residency? But the difference in the work between the first and second year is kind of astounding. Like when you have time and you can dig in, and when you have space and you can really dig in and do the work, it makes a big difference.
So beyond making art and beyond the residency, the Bray offers, again, a lot more things that people probably don't know about. Tell us about the classes, the Brickyard Network, which is your podcast, and then actually your gallery. So let's start with classes. So there's a residency, but can local people actually take classes here?
Yeah, we have a spring and a fall community classes. So those are all based on local, you know, local. You have to kind of live here because they're 8 weeks long, and they're taught by, we try to get our residents involved as much as possible. You know, they all come here with like a strange superpower of doing things. And so we try to build the classes around what their interests are. We also have a big band of classes that are just experience classes that may be 1 or 2 days. So it may be like a mom and kid class or a date night class. So those are really fun too. Also in education, we are just, you know, post-COVID going back and doing workshops. We used to do a lot of those. We don't do quite as much anymore. The pressure in Helena for hotel rooms in the summertime has gotten really, really strong. And we've also been rethinking about what we can do for education that maybe other places can't. So we have a beautiful education building. We've started running what were originally called incubator programs, where we brought in diverse groups of people and just gave them time and space and place. And we've recently changed the name of those to catalyst programs. I'm like, incubator sounds like they need to be protected. I'm like, this is a catalyst. It's like people coming together and then... So we had recently People's Pottery Project come. That's a group of previously incarcerated prisoners from California who started a ceramic kind of little ceramic studio to give people places to work when they first get out and give them some social skills, and it's really amazing. We had a what we called First Fire, and that was a group of, we had six indigenous people from across the country come and just kind of gave the building over to them, and they had a great just time, place, and space. So that's amazing.
We are at the Bray, and if the Archie Bray Foundation, and one of the things, again, if people don't know about the Bray Foundation, they might know more about it when they stop in the gallery. So you do have a gallery here that's open to the public. Jennifer and I are here in November, and it looks like you're getting ready for a big Christmas show. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the gallery and the sales and how that is operated.
Yeah, it's really part of our mission. So we have a gallery here on campus that we've had, I mean, it's been on campus for a long time. We recently expanded it during COVID. There's also a North Gallery, which has larger works in it. We've also just this past year opened a downtown gallery to bring in the people from Helena and Montana in, because it's often, lots of people know about the Bray, but if you didn't know about the Bray and you're just driving down like Little Country Club Road, you might not know that this is a place you can turn into and see some amazing stuff. So the downtown gallery's been great. One of the things we do is that in the downtown gallery, not only supporting the field of ceramics, but the artists, all the artists that are in the gallery are artists that have been here as residents. So it's a really great way to keep supporting them. We have a really generous kind of split between the commissions, so we really support them a lot. So that's amazing.
Bray Clay. So that's a separate business. Tell us what Bray Clay is about. Mm-hmm. I happen to know because in the summer I do a little bit of ceramics. It probably won't be in your gallery anytime soon, but I'm aware of Bray Clay and people from all over the world buy things from here.
Yeah.
Tell us what Bray Clay is.
Yeah, it's amazing. When I first got here, I was like, we have a clay factory? Like, it's pretty amazing. I don't think it's gotten the credit that it deserves. We service this whole part of the country, so this like upper northwest part of the country and the Mountain West. The next closest ceramic supplier is in Seattle, and there's one up in Canada. So we do a lot for that. We heavily support schools by giving them discounted clay materials. And I think that's one of the reasons we have so many great potters and artists coming out of Montana, is they've all been able to take advantage of it when they're in school. We carry ceramic supplies from many other vendors. So it's great for, you know, because we're quite rural out here and we have people who come from places where they didn't have a car or they're international. So it's great for the residents. They can just walk over there and get the tools and supplies they need. We also make some of our own clays. And one of the things that we're really interested in working on now is moving to keeping the ceramic supplier that we are, but moving into also being a ceramic research center. So my idea is like, I want a resident to be able to come here and say, I want to make a clay that expands 20% and melts into a sea of golden bubbles. And someone will say, we could do that. Like, game on. It's really exciting. And then we have so many residents that come through and maybe they make beautiful glazes. So we could say, oh, Lauren Mayberry, we love your green glaze. Like, we're going to market it for 2 years. We'll give you a dollar up for every pint we sell. So there's ways that I think that we can, because of where we sit and where we are and the number of people that come through here, we can source materials that maybe the bigger producers wouldn't bother with, right? And we can start making some really interesting clay bodies that maybe other people can't do. And, you know, Montana is a mineral-rich state, so there's lots of great clays here that we can source to.
So, listeners, even if you can't get a residency, you can order clay.
Absolutely.
We will have information on our website at Yellowstone Public Radio, not only about the foundation, but also how to buy clay and tools to make ceramics at home. But we're not at home. We're at the foundation. How is this whole operation funded?
You know, we have multiple income streams. We have the gallery, we have the clay business, we have education, we have, you know, after I think we're 73 years old, celebrating our 75th in 2026. We have a lot of people who love us and support us. We also received in 2022 a sizable endowment from the Wingate Foundation, which is amazing, which has enabled us to consider kind of all sorts of new ways of being in the world, which includes restoring the tile factory, getting out the permanent collection. So it's many ways. As many ways as we can think of, right? Is the best way to put it.
I went to the University of Montana, and I was lucky to be there when Rudy Adi was there and some other really important claymakers, Ken Little. But it was interesting because there was always sort of the division between ceramics and other artistic media. And a lot of universities did not consider ceramics as one of the fine arts. What is the definition and how did that all evolve?
Yeah, and I think, that's been kind of a long, slow burn, but it has changed. And I think one of the progenitors, the big progenitors of that were both Rudy Audio and Peter Volkas. I have a great photograph in my office, and we turned it into a postcard, but it has a young Peter Volkas, a young Rudy Audio, then Soji Hamada, Bernard Leach, and Yanagi. And those three had come through doing kind of a dog and pony show across the U.S. So here you have like these two young guys with just shirt sleeves rolled up, and then Bernard Leach, famous English potter, has his suit and tie and all that on. But again, it's like that idea of catalyst, like those ideas that formed and ways of making. And Rudy and Pete were here, and there's this beautiful, you know, Rudy Audio's work is beautiful, like lyrical painting, and then it turns into this sculpture. And then Pete's really taking this, the ceramic material, and just like using it as a material. So there's this huge stream of modernism that runs through Montana that I think we always think of Montana being, oh, there's Charlie Russell and his cowboy art, but there's so much modernism that happened through here. And then you have, you know, Frances Senska was both Rudy and Pete's teacher, and she was amazing and very interested in material and how do you make things and how do you do things. So it was a big shift from the European conception of art being about something, like being an allegory in the world, to the art being feeling. So there's this rawness of this American way of working in the West and the landscape. So that's the core of that. And it started here, which is amazing.
Maybe Montana just had room for them to grow and experiment and not be influenced by the art magazines and what they were covering. I always laugh about taking ceramics from Rudy Audio because I was such a good student in everything else, and I only got one B in art, and it was from Rudy Audio. It might have been his way of saying, well, maybe this isn't really your medium. What does it take to become a ceramic artist?
Oh, it's funny. I laugh. You have to have a really high tolerance for failure. And beyond that, I think you have to have like a joy in failure. Like that idea of like, yeah, let's try this thing. If it doesn't work, that's just the starting place. So a real kind of tenaciousness. Because you have to be able to, you know, spend all this time making something and then you put it in the kiln and it could come out completely the wrong. You know, it could just be ruined.
Which was going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of Rudy Audio and the pieces he was making and Peter Volkas. That brings up the question between form and function and how devoted they were to making art, not functional pottery. Tell us a little bit about that evolution. And when did ceramics move from making plates and cups and vases into standalone art pieces?
Yeah. And I think that's all happening around the same time then. And it was a kind of a slow shift. But, you know, if you think about it, like the construct between something, like what does functional mean? It means you can touch it? Does functional mean you have to eat cereal out of it? Or is functional also visual? Like so much of art is visual. And a lot of things that are functional or quasi-functional, you don't eat out of them or drink out of them. And so I think it's that funny line that the things wiggle between. And maybe part of that had to do with the things being made at the brick factory. You know, there's the bricks, which are just like a thing that you build more things with. And then there's the very utilitarian objects. And then I think, you know, when Leach and Hamada and Yanagi are over here, they're thinking about, they're coming over here and they're giving to the Americans this idea that there's beauty in these things. They're not simply like a bucket or a shovel, right? It's not just about utility. It's about how does it look? How does it feel? What does it do? So I think that became part of that. And then again, making the work not about an allegory or this means this or this has to do with this, and making it about what did you feel when you did that. I think ceramics just really was, it just fits that because it's so malleable. It doesn't have any shape that it has to be. It'll be whatever you want it to be within whatever reason it has. It's a collaboration, but I think it's really interesting. So there's possibility there. But I think it wasn't until, oh my goodness, I think probably until almost all the way up to COVID before we finally got to this point where people aren't talking about art and craft anymore. They're really just talking about art, right? There's still functional pottery and that still exists, but it doesn't have that same strong sense of separation.
I loved the American Craft Museum in New York. And it was interesting because it was right next to the Museum of Modern Art. And I always wondered what was good enough to get out of the craft museum and into the art museum. But there was a real definition or a separation of crafts and art, fine arts. I think that's disappeared. Mm-hmm. This is maybe a more philosophical question, but can you address that?
Yeah. And I remember, you know, when I was an undergrad in Philadelphia in the early 90s, it was a big, is it art versus craft? That was a big question, and it's not a question anymore. And I don't think, and it may be because our love for craft has somewhat gone away. I mean, you see craft is no longer in that museum's name. There's many museums where it's the things that were the craft museum became the something else museum, or the College of Not became not the College of Something and Craft. It's just art. So, and I do think it's kind of a false construct between craft being more about making and more about material, because that became so important to art starting way back, right, with Peter Volkas and John Cage, and you know, where it became more about the experience. So, and it's not so much about, you know, when I taught at the Royal College, we'd go and we'd look at the plaster casts where they used to go and spend hours drawing and copying, right? So that's like a really strange, that's more of a craft almost than what was happening here. So I think that there was just a erasure of lines. Like, you didn't have to spend a lot of time learning the right way to do something, because it's not about that.
Rebecca, I'm going to ask you a question that probably our listeners have no interest in whatsoever, but you and I could probably talk about it for a long time. When I was in graduate school, it was material abstraction, and most of the artists were working with material to create things, not to represent things. Mm-hmm. I was in LA at the time, and it was a huge movement that art and the material was the subject. Mm-hmm. It wasn't separate from making a painting or creating a functional item.
Mm-hmm. And that probably really helped to erase the lines, particularly in ceramics, because it's such a, you know, unlike paint, it can stand up by itself, right? And you can be fat, it can be thin, it can be, it's really, really malleable. And it's also just really interesting to think about things as things. And a lot of it still has to do with, you know, still in ceramics, there's great veins that run through where people who do a lot of figurative work or people who do work that's kind of more based in concept. So there's all, but there's room for all of that in ceramics. It doesn't have to be just one or the other. And I think the lines have erased. Again, when I was an undergrad, it's like if you had to choose if you made functional work or sculptural work, you couldn't. It was like taking a religious vow. You could not go back and forth. So it's really interesting. Our residents now, they're just fluid.
Which brings up the question, is there a trend in art and ceramics right now? Have styles changed? Have you seen styles change over the years? Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And one of the things, you know, we were visiting just a little bit earlier and talking about our permanent collection and getting that unearthed, and it's going to be amazing to be able to see decade by decade the changes that have happened and the conversations that have occurred. I think right now there's a real shift in just a kind of total dropping of, like, what's the right way to do something, right? It used to be your train, you do this, then you do this, and then you do this, and here's how you make a successful piece. And now it's just like, whatever you want to do. And there's so many people who are kind of ceramic adjacent who are coming in. We had a great fashion designer came last summer and was doing some really interesting things. She was a pattern maker in New York. And then we had an architect from Canada come down and do some really interesting things. So one of the things I love about the Bray is that the lens is very ceramic centric, but you can come at it from any kind of any place. And that's, I think, been really interesting in the field, because it's not just, is it a sculpture or is it a pot? It's like, could be anything.
And certainly the material itself addresses some of those concerns. There's so many different kinds of clay. So I remember when people were doing porcelain, it looked like porcelain. And, you know, gray clay was one thing, earthenware was something else. But you're saying people are blurring those boundaries.
Absolutely. In my studio, I probably have 15 different kinds of clay bodies. And I do all the things I was not supposed to as an undergrad, put clay on top of glaze and refire things and add sand and stick stuff together. Like, there's just a real, it feels like what must have felt like when Pete and Rudy and Francis were trying to figure out, like, how do you make clay? Like, where do you get clay? How do you make a kiln? How do you fire this stuff? So what makes a glaze? So it's really interesting and fruitful time to be in ceramics, because there's so many opportunities to do things and so many ways to connect with people who are doing interesting things, but there's less rules.
Do you think that is what continues to attract artists from around the world, that sense of freedom that exists here at the Bray?
Definitely. And I think it's also like that sense of the ability to be wildly experimental. I looked at several other kind of historic artist residencies across the U.S., and often they are slightly rural or in a place that has like a lot of space, right? A lot of space. You can do things and you can try things, and they're not. And I was reading something else I talked about. Like, if you want to think about big things, you need to have lots of space above your head. We have lots of space above our heads here. It's really great.
Which makes me also think about the Bray Sculpture Garden. And these are pieces that don't fit into your living room very well. I mean, some major sculptural pieces. What is out there in your sculpture garden?
Oh my gosh. We have 26 acres here. And most of the pieces are just left by residents as they leave. Like, maybe they're going back to Europe and they can't take the piece with them and they put it here. But they intentionally place it next to something else that they like. And the pieces change over time. Some pieces walk away. Some pieces get broken. But it's really interesting. And it's so, I think it's one of our visitors' favorite things to do is just wander around, because you always see something different.
Rebecca, this has been so much fun. Do you have anything else you would like our listeners to know about the Bray Foundation?
Just that, you know, you are welcome to come here. There's no admission fee. We have lots of places to park. There's 26 acres. Bring a picnic. Talk to the artists. Right now we have an artist from South Africa. Yanina was here from the Ukraine. We had an artist last year from Korea. We have people from across the United States and around the world, and they are genuinely interested in talking to you.
What a wonderful opportunity. We will have more information about the Bray Foundation on our website and a link to the Bray Foundation. Rebecca, thank you so much for having us here at the Bray Foundation, Helena, Montana.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Corby Skinner, Jennifer Corning, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at yprradio.org.